Good evening. Thank you for your introduction. My topic tonight is evolving Japanese perspectives on death and dying. Japanese attitudes towards death and dying have gone through profound changes during the 20th century. Three different periods with divergent attitudes stand out. First, the period of idealizing death and dying for the emperor and for the country during World War II. Secondly, the long period of treating death and dying as a taboo subject from 1946 to 1986. And thirdly, the growth of the hospice movement characterized by a newly awakened interest in death education and in improving terminal care for the dying and grief care for the bereaved. That's from 1986 to the present. The first period is idealizing death and dying for the emperor and for the country. As you all know, during World War II, dying for the emperor and for Japan was propagated as an honorable and ideal way of dying. Elements of the traditional samurai ethic were received. About 1.5 million soldiers, well, fathers, husbands, sons, died a so-called heroic death fighting for the emperor, and families were not supposed to grieve or feel regret, but rather they were supposed to be proud of the death of their loved ones, which of course was a big obstacle to the real grief process. In 1944, the Kamikaze Special Attack Force, kamikaze meaning wind of the gods, started to attack Allied ships in suicide dives. Many of the pilots were college students, some were teenagers with less than 2 months of flight training. About 2,200 kamikaze pilots sacrificed their lives in these suicide attacks. The night before certain death, some young pilots wrote enthusiastic letters to their parents showing their joy and pride at being chosen to offer their young lives to the emperor. I just talked to a former kamikaze pilot who is now the person in charge of one of the chapters that I founded of the Japanese Association for Death Education and Grief Counseling. And he was supposed to die the next day to fly and attack an American ship. And so he was all prepared. And the next morning, when he walked to his plane, he was told the war has ended. So I asked him, how did you feel that morning? And he said, I felt terribly. I wanted to die. So that means these young people, they were really indoctrinated to die. And at least this man who is still alive, he was disappointed that he could not die, for which he had trained now for several months. The night before, they wrote letters, but during the constant flow of reports about so-called heroic death, on the battlefield, the Japanese began to experience, of course, mega death, where even the otherwise skillful propaganda of radio and newspapers found it difficult to idealize death, especially the bombing of this city of Tokyo on March the 10th, 1945, killed 100,000 people in one day. And in Kobe, 60,000 died in the bombings. And finally, of course, the atomic bomb on Hiroshima on August the 6th, 1945, left about 75,000 dead, and 3 days later, there were 39,000 dead in Nagasaki. So this is the first period on death and dying in Japan. The second period is now death as a taboo subject in Japan from 1946 to 1986. The topic of death became a taboo after the war. After having experienced so much senseless death, we can sympathize with the Japanese people in their efforts to avoid the subject as much as possible. I remember two former students of mine coming to my office in 1980 and asking that in my speech at their wedding party, I should not mention that both of them had taken my philosophy of death course at Sofia University, because they were afraid that I would praise them for taking this course. And they said that would upset the guest. The word death is an absolute taboo at a wedding, they told me. Of course, I knew that already, and I would never have talked about philosophy of death. I would simply have said that, taken my philosophy course, not you have a user. But then I have had the experience in many hospitals, when I did research in Japanese hospitals, that many hospitals did not have the room number 4, and as you all know already, the word for 4 is she, and the word for death is also she. So many hospitals will not have a room number 4. And in my lectures all over the country, we had often, after my lecture, a reception in one of the hotels, and at the entrance, I have experienced it several times, they wrote then, Sei Toshi o Kangaeru Kai, this Society for Death Education and Grief Counseling. And in one hotel in Okayama, I remember the manager of the hospital came running to me and said, please take away Sei Toshi o Kangaeru Kai. We have also a wedding reception today in the same hotel, and the guests would be upset to see even the word she in at the entrance. Well, that was absolutely taboo to even talk about death. Medical education after 1945 was directed toward cure and prolongation of life alone. I have talked to many medical doctors who told me the same story, that in 6 years of their medical education, the topic of death was never mentioned. It was only that their professors would tell them, if a patient has incurable cancer and you know he will be dying, please don't tell him that. Talk to the families, but never to the patient about his or her approaching death, or that this is a cancer that cannot be cured anymore. That was the amount of education about death they received in the medical schools. In 1987, the Ministry of Health and Welfare appointed a committee to study the complex issues of caring for the terminally ill and ways to care for the dying. I was the only Henna Gaijin, the only foreigner in this committee, and we worked for 2 years to develop guidelines for better care for cancer patients. And in that process, I learned a lot about the difficulties of death in the medical profession. Our presiding person in this committee was Professor Morioka, who had operated on the emperor, and we all knew that he hadn't told the truth to the emperor. So it was very difficult for us to discuss the issue of truth-telling to cancer patients. But since I was the only Henna Gaijin, so I thought I have to do this unpleasant job, and I suggested, I think good to tell the truth to cancer patients in order to have better communication between the doctor and the patient, as well as between the patient and his or her family. And you wouldn't believe what objections I got from the officials of the Ministry of Health. They said, now we are here in Japan, and in Japan we do not tell the truth to cancer patients. And there was a long, long discussion. But eventually, after 2 years, our committee worked for 2 years in the ministry, everybody agreed that it would be better to tell the truth. And recently, I was in another committee in the ministry, and I asked a very simple question now, since we published that in the year, this was published, our recommendation, our guidelines in the year 1989. Now, after 18 years, how is it now? And the Ministry of Health were very happy and said, well, there was a big success already. Over 50% of the doctors tell the truth now. Né? So he thought that was a big success, né, that we made the suggestion at that time. But that shows you, that is, of course, the absolute, I come back later to the whole issue of hospice, the hospice movement, a basic obstacle of the hospice movement. If you don't tell the truth to a cancer patient, how can you then ask him or her, do you want to spend the last days in a general hospital with a lot of machines, or do you prefer to hospice, or perhaps even a home care hospice? Né? You cannot ask the question if you do not tell the truth about his or her situation. So for me, one of the big goals at that time was to develop the hospice movement, because there was only one hospice in the whole of Japan, and I come back later to this issue, that this question of truth-telling to patients is for me also, since I was teaching philosophical anthropology here at Sophia University, also a question of the dignity of man, the dignity that we respect, the dignity of a human person. And for that, it is, of course, not only, it is, in my opinion, necessary that we do not tell lies on such important issues. Because I have experience, I've worked in American hospices and hospitals, and also in Germany and here in Japan, and I have experienced many, many patients who, after having been told that they have incurable cancer, that they really did a lot to solve unsolved problems, especially family problems, or took care of the issues of their companies. And so it doesn't mean that, as I was asked by a high official in the ministry, do you really think that truth-telling is the right way? Do you really think that we could should deprive the patient of hope? And there, of course, I got my homework on the issue of hope, because I have experienced a few hundred people dying, and I know that every person holds on to hope till the last hour, but the object of hope is changing all the time. If a person is told that he or she has cancer, of course, he or she cannot hope anymore not to have cancer, but they usually have hope then that operation or whatever will cure them from the cancer. But then if at the time of the operation they find out that the cancer is not curable, and if they then opt to go to a hospice, that doesn't mean that at the entrance of the hospice is written, everybody who enters here should give up all hope. They then still hope to have good pain control, and also that they have somebody till the last, till the end, accompanying them. What we you say in German is Sterbebegleitung. That is another hope, but that is a very important hope, because in our committee, the probably the number one pain control expert was always sitting next to me, and he said, he said probably not to me, but in all probably, that at that time, in Japan, in Japanese university hospitals, about 47% of the patients received sufficient pain control. 47%. That means, in other words, more than half did not receive sufficient pain control at that time. And I knew at that time in other countries there were already better pain control available, but of course in Japan we have a very strong group of a very strong industry who doesn't want to import that if they can develop it in a few years. But in these few years, the patients have to suffer. And he said, he did his research on university hospitals only, that of course the other general hospitals were of course much worse, he told me. Né? But this is also an issue where things have enormously improved in Japan. Since our committee meeting, the pain control has improved a lot in Japan, and they use also more morphine now than they did before, but still it is not sufficient. And of course, if we get sick, we don't know whether this hospital has a good pain control or not. I know from some of my former students who work in retirement homes in Tokyo, in this big city, and they tell me they do not use pain control at all because there's nobody, no doctor who can do it. But the other bigger issue is they don't want to spend money on it. And that is not 20 years ago, that is at present this year. Now, the important issue that has not been resolved is in Japan, of course, if after somebody, a patient, is told about incurable cancer, who can do the emotional or spiritual support for these patients after they have been told the truth about their condition. The lack of emotional support and spiritual care for patients facing death remains a basic problem today. In Europe and the United States, we have seen hundreds of hospitals and also of hospices, in fact, over 200 hospices. They usually have, of course, chaplains or counselors who offer emotional and spiritual support. In Japan, however, one of the big issues is that the Buddhists cannot fulfill this role in hospitals or hospices to a large extent, because as many Buddhist priests have told me, that they are turned away from hospitals, or because they simply tell them the Buddhist priest is so much connected with the funeral that many patients in the hospital, if they see a Buddhist priest coming in, that they believe that they are now ready to prepare for the funeral with the relatives, and so that they consider that as an unwelcome visit. That is improving a little bit. There are now, I have a lot of discussions with Buddhist, especially younger Buddhist priests. They are very much interested in fulfilling this role of a chaplain in hospitals or hospices, but the image has to be changed in order to be accepted in these institutions. I'm now coming to the third period that I mentioned. There are three periods in the 20th century in Japan. The third period in the evolution of Japanese attitudes toward death and dying is that of the growing hospice movement, characterized by a newly awakened interest in death education and improving terminal care for the dying and of grief care for the bereaved. That is the new era. And it started around 1986, and of course it continues till today and is still growing very much. When I realized that there was no grief care at all, Japanese hospitals, when the patient has died, that is the end of the contact with the families, then I thought it may be a good idea to develop a grief care program outside the hospitals. The hospitals are not doing it anyhow. So in the year 1982, I founded the Japanese Association for Death Education and Grief Counseling, I will afterwards refer it in an abbreviated form as simply as association. So the foundation, I suggested that this organization should have three goals. The first goal is providing death education, education about death and dying, grief, bereavement, and so on, for both hospital and hospice staff, for the general public, and also for junior and senior high schools. That's the first goal, death education. Then the second goal is improving terminal care in hospitals and developing hospice programs. And the third goal, establishing mutual support groups for bereaved people, which at that time did not exist in Japan. Besides these three goals, each chapter is encouraged to creatively develop new activities according to their own concrete needs. So I will briefly describe these three goals. The first goal is death education. Each of the, we have now 53 chapters in Japan with about 5,000 members. They, from Hokkaido to Okinawa, in all the major cities like Sapporo, Tomakomai, Asahikawa, and also in Okayama, Kobe, and in all the major cities we have Akita, we have a chapter of the association, and the association is run all by volunteers. Now the first goal, death education, each of these 53 chapters, they have on principle every month a lecture for doctors, nurses, and also for the general public on topics care for the dying, for pain on pain control, how to teach children about death and dying, on hospice care, home care hospice, the role of the hospice volunteer, bereavement and grief at the loss of a spouse, complicated grief, the meaning of the funeral, etc. Topics like that. We offer them every month a lecture. And usually we invite medical doctors, nurses, or grief specialists on grief care who offer these, And then besides that, usually once a year, a big one-day or two-day seminar. I did that, if you know Sophia University, we have this 800-seat lecture hall here, number 10 building, and for about 20 years, I have had a two-day seminar there, and always 800 people, and sometimes we had to turn away 2,000 people who applied for it, and always 800 people was always filled on all these topics on death education. And I published six volumes on the proceedings of these seminars. One is called Thinking About Life and Death, in Japanese, Seito Shio Kangaeru, one losing one's spouse, learning from the death of a loved one, hospices and terminal care in Japan, a new culture of death, sudden death and grief. These are all different topics that we have treated, and I published later on then the proceedings in book form. I brought a few books along in the room next door if you want to take a look at it afterwards. I myself gave every week a lecture on NHK television on these topics, and that came out under the title Shitado Mukyaoka, on facing death. And that's also now translated from Japanese into Korean. It's also a bestseller in Korea. In Japan it has already 27 editions now. So this is the first big issue, education about death, dying, bereavement, grief, funeral, and all these issues. We had also one seminar just on the funeral, on the meaning of the funeral, and which is a very important issue in Japan because there are a lot of problems with funerals, and also about the money of the funerals. I don't know whether you're aware that average funeral in Japan costs 11 times more than a funeral in England. That's quite a bit of money. But there are also many other problems about the funeral. Now, the second goal of these of this association, as I said, which has now 53 chapters all over Japan, is improving improving terminal care in hospitals and developing hospice programs. In 1981, there was only one hospice in the whole of Japan, and we have now practically every year several lectures on in all these chapters, and I take every year about 30 Japanese medical doctors and nurses to visit hospices in Australia, in New Zealand, in Hawaii, USA East Coast, USA West Coast, Canada, Ireland, England, Germany, Austria. And many of these doctors who have come along on these hospice tours, after they return to Japan, they have started hospices in here in Japan, like here, St. John's Hospice in Tokyo also. The medical doctor, he came along with me. And last year we went to Austria and Germany, this year to Ireland and England, and next year I plan a tour to Australia, to Melbourne and to Sydney. And so we have now today, as I said, in 1981 there was one hospice, and now we have 173 hospices in Japan. And that is, I think, a very great improvement, better care. I always stress, you do not enter a hospice to die, but to live in a humane way till the end. And the hospice movement, I think, is an enormous improvement in terminal care in Japan. For 20 years, I have offered every year at Sophia University in an evening course in the community college, a course on hospice volunteer training. So on the average, usually between 100 and 150 people came every year, Friday night at 7 o'clock here. Most of them come direct from work and took this course. And many of them are working now not only in the hospices of the Tokyo area, but also in many hospitals and even at the Tokyo Cancer Institute. And now volunteers are absolutely absolutely needed for hospice work. As I said, I have for 20 years, I've every year taken a group of Japanese doctors and nurses. I have visited over 200 hospices around the world, and that's what impressed me very much, that often they are for 20 patients, like in Tokyo, St. John's Hospice has 20 beds and 100 volunteers working there, many of them trained here at this university. So this is an enormous improvement in Japan. And during the pioneer years, Japanese hospices did not receive money, any financial support. But during the past years, this has improved a lot. And I must say, when I have been working, and I'm still working in the several committees in the Ministry of Health, and when you talk about improving terminal care in general ways, and that it's better for human beings to die in a more humane way, you don't notice much interest. But the moment you use the word cost cutting, everybody starts listening, everybody starts taking and so I try to get this point across, that to keep dying patients in high-tech hospitals is much more expensive than to have them spend the last weeks in a hospice where you have no machines at all. There are no life prolonging machines in the hospital, so you can cut costs. And that convinced the ministry people. They got interested in that. And now, actually, in Japan, hospices get per patient per day 2,000 sen per patient per day. I don't know in US dollars, is it something around $300, or I'm not sure about the 250 dollars a day, which is quite. So most people who work in hospitals, they say they can cover the basic costs. Of course, they need some extra if they want to introduce what I always recommend: music therapy, art therapy, bibliotherapy, and all these things that are not covered by the government or by insurance. But it's quite an improvement also in the financing of hospices, and that has, of course, improved. And I am also working in a foundation. We give money to new hospices, usually 3 OQN for a new hospice, for the building, if they give us the plans. They have to show us the plans so that it is a real hospice, and so, because there are abuses too. And also in this foundation, we give money, scholarships to 80 nurses every year, and we have now already several thousand nurses who have had taken this hospice courses and have now the title hospice nurse after graduating from this course. And we give them the full scholarship, and 4 nurses can go to abroad to study abroad too. They get scholarships, and even some doctors now, if they want to go abroad, and they. Now this is our second goal, the improving terminal care and helping people to face the final stage in a more humane way. And of course, as I said earlier, the pain control, that is also one very basic issue which has improved a lot. Now the third goal of the association that I founded, as I said, in 1982. The third goal is establishing mutual support groups for bereaved people. Now, in the United States, where I did my graduate studies in New York, I discovered very early that the big difference between a hospital and a hospice, in hospitals, the patient is at the center of attention all the time. And in a hospice, the patient and the family are considered as one unit from the very beginning. So care for the families who are facing the loss of a father or mother or husband or wife or child is an essential part of the American hospice movement. So the American Hospice Association has a strict rule that whenever a patient dies in a hospice, the hospice is obliged to offer a 1-year grief care for the families. And they usually do it in the hospice. They usually have one room, or in Australia, I was very impressed. I go there again next year in Sydney. This Calvary Hospice is the name. They have an extra building right next to the hospice building, and that's exclusively for grief care. There is a trained grief counselor who has studied psychology, and he has trained 12 volunteers as grief counselors, and they have a whole house for themselves, and they usually will send a letter or give a phone call to the families a few weeks after the death of the patient, because right after death, the families are usually busy with the funeral and finding a new job or whatever. But usually after 3 or 4 weeks, when they have settled down a little bit, then they will get receive a phone call from the from this bereaved center and invite them. If you want to try out here, you can come into a group in a bereaved group, or also get private counseling. Now, what I did here in Japan, I made it a point that all of these 53 chapters, they offer every month grief groups, mutual support groups. And here in Tokyo, the Tokyo Seito Shio Kangaru Kai, the Tokyo chapter of the Association for Death and Bereavement, we have every month here in Yotsuya three bereavement groups. One is called Cosmos Nokai, that is for widows and widowers. The second is Sumira Nokai, that is for parents who have lost a child. And the third group is Vasuri Nagusa Nokai, that is for families after a loss through suicide. We don't use the word, Japanese word, jisatsu, because it sounds for the families, it's very satsu, ne? That is very hard. So we always use the word jishi, ne? Jishi for suicide. But we get people coming by Shinkansen from Nagoya who come here and they tell me, well, so far I couldn't talk about that my husband committed suicide. This is the first time that I can talk, because they know here everybody in this room has the same experience. Everybody has lost somebody through suicide. And so that's called Vasuri Nagusa Nokai. So we have every month these three groups here, and many have told me that by being able to talk about it, they recovered, and they are now working. Many of them are working as volunteers, helping also as volunteers in these various chapters. Now, the third group is especially important because, as you know, there are an average of 94 suicides a day in Japan. They are published. I know from my experience, I meet a lot of people who do not appear in the statistics, wives of medical doctors who have told me, you know, my husband committed suicide, but I asked a friend, a doctor friend, to write something else. So many people do not appear. So the real number of suicides in Japan is probably closer to 120 a day, né? But the published figure is 94. So this is a very important issue because the families feel shame and they feel often guilt feelings that they didn't support their husband when he lost his job. And many have told me, if I had at that time supported my husband more, he needed emotional support after he was suddenly fired from his company, Ristora, as you know, Ristora, that's a huge number of people. After Ristora, they commit suicide, they jump in front of the chew line here. Ne? That's the reason, incidentally, why I go every day, you know, I practice every week a lecture where I have to go to by Shinkansen, and I have to catch the Nozomi in Tokyo. Ne? But, you know, from Yotsuya Station to Tokyo Station, it takes only 10 minutes, and I leave the campus here 1 hour earlier, only because of suicides. I have had so often the experience that the Chuo-sen doesn't run, especially I give often lectures on Saturdays and Sundays, and somebody jumps in front of the Chuo line, and the Chuo line doesn't work. And I had one recently, and there were 1,300 people waiting for my lecture in Nara. And if I don't catch this Nozomi, you know, I won't be there in time, and these 1,300 were waiting for me. So I ran to the subway, the Marunouchi line. I went by subway. When I arrived in Tokyo Station, you know, I was already giri-giri, and I rushed with my big bag to the Nozomi. And just as I tried to get into the train, it closed like this. Né? And of course, this way the train doesn't move, so the door opened again and it went Nozomi Dori. But I have had this experience so often, so I always leave 1 hour before to avoid this problem. Now, as I said, these people who have a suicide experience in their families, they need a mutual support group where they can talk about it. By just being forced to hide it, not being allowed to talk it, because nobody in Japanese society wants to hear about it, and also the fear that it may damage the marriage potential of their children. That's a very big issue in Japan. I have had that several times here at Sophia University. You know, two of my former students who had taken my philosophy of death course, they wanted to marry, to have their wedding in the Kulturheim Chapel here on campus. Ne? And we had the rehearsal and everything, and 2 days before the actual wedding, they came crying and said, we would like to cancel the wedding. And I asked them, I thought that they had a problem. They had no problem at all. The oldest brother of the bridegroom had committed suicide somewhere in Inaka. And of course, you can't, in Japan, you cannot have a wedding 2 days after a funeral. So I said, well, then if you want, you know, you can wait about 2 or 3 months, and if you want, I can then reserve the Kulturheim Chapel again for you. And as it turned out, her family was absolutely opposed. They said, you will under no circumstances marry somebody who has a suicide in the family. That's a very big issue in Japan, that they say. And I told her, I explained to her, the ani is the ani, and the ototo is a beautiful boy, and you should think about it. But I said, yeah, I have been thinking about it, but my family is absolutely opposed, does not allow me to. And they just didn't marry. Né? So, but the older brother, the ani in the Inaka, when he committed suicide, he certainly didn't think that he would not only kill himself, but he would also kill the happiness of his ototo, of his younger brother, and he would kill also the happiness of the bride of his younger brother. That is a very big issue. Therefore, Japanese people, they hide, they try to hide the fact that somebody in the family has committed suicide. And all the more, I think, we have to offer them a space and a opportunity to talk about it. And first to find out, that's what many people tell me, they have to find out, I am not the only one who has experience. Here, everybody in this room has the same experience. And then they can, by talking about it, they can also search for ways how to live now after suicide in the family, which is very, very difficult in Japan. Precisely because you don't have the social support if you cannot talk about it. Now, these are the three goals of the association. And as I said, in these 53 cities in Japan, we have every month also mutual support groups for bereaved. And in that way, I think a lot of people who have gone through this enormous crisis of losing somebody, they find a way to live again. Incidentally, in English, we use the word widow for somebody who, and some of you who have studied Japanese probably have learned that widow in Japanese means mibojin. That's not correct. I use the word mibojin in an NHK television program, and the program was immediately stopped and said, we have to do the whole program again from the beginning because mibojin is a sabetsu yogo. You are not allowed to use the word mibojin in NHK. Né? So we had to do the same program all over again. And it's very tough, you know, when you sit in front of the camera, you're not allowed to look at your manuscript. You have to do it all by heart. Né? And to for 30 minutes just in front of the camera, and you have to supposed to always in, told that you have to look into the camera, and we had to do the whole program. We had 25 minutes done, and then I had to start all over again because of the miboji. So don't ever believe when you have learned in a language school that a widow in English means miboji in Japan. It doesn't mean miboji. It means otto ushinatta tsuma. That's the Japanese, the NHK Japanese. Né? Now, they are all now I personally believe, too, that mibojin is not a fortunate formulation because of the lady who has not yet died. I think that is not a good, but I suffered from that. Né? Now, I have one more point that I try in this to this Association of Death and Grief Counseling to spread is the memorial services. We did just a memorial service here in Yotsuya just a week ago, last Sunday, and 110 bereaved people came to that, and I will have another one in Toyohashi next month, I encourage all these 53 chapters. We have every year once a memorial service, né, where they can come, and where we do it in different ways, sometimes in a religious context, in a Buddhist temple, sometimes in a Christian church, and sometimes, like last Sunday, we did it in a meeting room. And usually I talk for half an hour about loss and grief, né, and about the experience of grief. Then we usually have some music therapy. We often have last Sunday too, we had some very beautiful music, and they always tell me this music has a healing impact. So I believe in this music therapy. And after that, I divide them up in groups of 8 or 5 or 10. We had 110, so we had usually 10 at one table. And then they can talk to each other about their loss experience and about their pain and their grief. And I use this German proverb. It's very famous, where geteilte Freude ist doppelte Freude, geteiltes Leid ist halbes Leid. In Japanese, tomoni yorokobu no wa nibai no yorokobi, tomoni kurushimi no wa hanbun no kurushimi. That if you can talk about some joyful thing, that you double your joy. And if you can talk about your pain, if you have somebody who listens to your pain, that lessens the pain. That's the meaning of the original German proverb. And I think the role of both the bereavement groups and also the memorial service, where they then in the second half of the memorial, they can talk to each other. And I always feel that the people, by talking about it, by being able to have to express their pain, and also to have people who listen with sympathy, I think that has a healing effect. Even if it's not half the pain, as the German proverb says, but it is. And I often use the Japanese word kiki for your crisis, kiki. That kiki has the two characters. The first one is abunai, the dangerous aspect, the negative aspect. And the second is chance. Né? The second key of kiki is chance, so that every kiki, every crisis experience is also a chance for personality growth, or for growing as a human person. And a lot of people find that very helpful. Né? That these people who have suffered the loss of a loved one, they all know that this is a very painful. It's probably the most painful crisis, kiki, in their life. But it has not only a negative aspect. It was first, this new word was coined in German by Freud, Trauerarbeit, né? In English, grief work, in Japanese, Hitan no Shigoto or Mono Sagyo, both are used in Japanese, Hitan no Shigoto. So I always stress that it is not only a passive suffering that you go through when you lose a loved one, but it has also demands an active doryoku, an active arbeit or grief work to walk through the way. If any one of you is interested, I wrote 30 books in Japanese about this, and the first one is also, if you want to, you can pass them around. The first one is also about grief, Shitodomu Gyauka. And then I have another one on the second page on top. That is, I published that together with this famous writer, Yanagi Yakuyo. His son committed suicide, and then I offered to him that we could have one day seminar here at Jochi Daigaku in Sophia University, and have different people talk about the issue of sudden death and grief, né? Because sudden death, grief after sudden death, is different from grief if you know that your father or mother will die from cancer in 3 weeks. Then you can you can prepare your soul, or you can prepare yourself that, and you know for 3 weeks your father or your mother or your husband or wife will die, but you can be. But after sudden death, there's of course no preparation. You suddenly, it hits you, and so after suicide, and we had a whole day here with 800 people here in our biggest lecture hall at Sophia University. And afterwards, we published it as a book on the second page on the top. It's still available. And I brought a copy. It's in the room next door. You can afterwards look at the... this is the book I published by NHK. one more issue I will just very briefly touch is the issue of disenfranchised grief. Disenfranchised grief is not yet in the most American or English dictionary, so it's not very well known. For those who know Japanese, it's konin saretinai hitan. I published an article in Japanese about it, konin saretinai hitan. This is disenfranchised grief, but it's not yet, it's a new English word which is not yet in most of the English dictionaries. But it's a very important issue because many people experience a loss. They have no support, and this disenfranchised grief means that can have three reasons. One is the relationship is not recognized. The second reason is the loss is not recognized, and the third reason can be the griever is not recognized. So it's the first one. So in Japanese, aru kankei wa konin saretinai. For example, for homosexuals or people for homo no kanke, if one partner dies, this person who lost his or her friend has not the usual social support that an ordinary person has who loses his wife, his father, or whoever. And that is called in English now disenfranchised grief. And in the article I published in a Japanese journal, if anybody's interested, I call it konin saretinai hitan. And the second type is the loss is not recognized. Aru soshitsu wa konin saretinai. For example, in the case of abortion or a pet loss too. Many elderly people, when they lose their dog or their cat, nobody thinks that's a big deal, but for an elderly person in Japan, it can be a very hard loss. But nobody thinks about it. And I have heard from children, the elderly have told me, the son tells you, oh, Pap, now we'll buy you another dog or another cat. But that's not the issue. He lost or she lost her pet, which is a very important pet to him or her. And you cannot just say, well, we'll just buy another cat for you. Don't worry about it. That's the second type of disenfranchised grief, konin saretinai hitan. And the third type is that the griever is not recognized. Hitan suru hito wa konin saretinai. And that's especially for children and elderly. So many families in Japan, if somebody dies, like say the grandfather dies, they won't take the children to the funeral because they said, oh, the children cannot yet understand that. But children grieve too. And elderly are sometimes excluded from the funeral. They say, oh, he is already suffers from dementia. He doesn't know what's going on. So they don't even tell him that an important family and the important person in the family has died, and that's also disenfranchised grief. So in general, disenfranchised grief means that a person gets not the social support in his or her grief work, and that's a very big issue. If anybody's interested, I published an article in Japanese about it in the magazine Terminal Care. The title is Konin Saretinai Hitan, which is also a very important issue about which I often talk here in Japan. And another issue that I just want to, I want to touch very briefly is grief after death from overwork, karoshi in Japanese. Né? Karoshi is death from overwork. And Hiroshi Kawahito, the Secretary General of the National Defense Council of Victims of Karoshi, claims that an estimated 10,000 Japanese, 10,000, die from karoshi each year, from grief after death from overwork. And one of the big issues is that companies do not want to admit that this employee has died from karoshi, because then they would have to pay for it. Né? And so the government, of course, is always thinking about money, and they made very clever rules, that if a victim, now listen carefully, if a victim has worked 16 hours a day for 7 consecutive days prior to his death, he has a chance of being classified as a karoshi victim. Now I repeat, if a victim has worked 16 hours a day for 7 consecutive days, if there's a break in between, no chance, then you maybe have a chance. Yeah, that doesn't mean you get the money. You have a chance to be classified as a karoshi victim. And so I have talked to some people, and they are mad like hell, both at the company, that the company, let a husband or father or whoever it was, work himself to death. But then they have also often guilt feelings about their own attitude, that they did not tell the husband or the company, now this, you cannot do that, or that's just not human anymore. And there you have very special, complicated grief. One more complicated grief case is, of course, if there is a multiple loss. I used to go to Kobe quite often after the earthquake, and there we had many, many cases of multiple loss. That means first, and on the day of the earthquake, people that I met there, they lost their mother, their father, one child, the house, and the job. That's a lot of loss in one day. But then I went back a month later, and then one of the women whom I had met the month before, she said, "And now my husband committed suicide." That's a lot of loss together. So if we meet people who have had a loss experience, we should also inquire whether there are other losses in the same time period, for example, in the last half a year and so. And a very typical case I have found often is that somebody has a loss of his job, either by early retirement or by normal retirement, and loses during the same half year or during the same year his wife. Né? That's also a double loss, or sometimes multiple loss. And that's often complicated grief. Then, you cannot just think that they will recover the same way as somebody who has had just one loss. So double loss, multiple loss, that's a very big issue. Now, we are coming to an end. I will leave some time for the discussion. As a conclusion, I would say we have to be aware that different cultures have indeed different attitudes toward death and dying, as well as toward bereavement and grief. Japanese perspectives on death and dying are not a static phenomenon, and I want to stress it very much, but are rather in a dynamic, evolving process. Né? Therefore, I have picked as a title, Evolving Japanese Perspectives, né, in the plural. So the whole, during the 20th century and also now in the 21st century, we are living in a time of, as Professor Kullmann also mentioned at the beginning, we are living in a period where things are changing, and changing very much through the, of course, through the whole population change, the longer life expectancy, but also that the whole cultural phenomenon, the attitudes, for example, the hospice movement, when you figure that 1981, only one hospice in Japan, and now we have 173, things have improved a lot, and we can improve. And I always say we should not just say, oh, that's Japanese culture, or that's the Japanese way, but that's, as human beings, I think we all have a responsibility to not only to be regulated by what is or what has been so far, but also ask the question of what is a humane way of spending your last days, what is a humane way of living and dying. And I think there is still a lot of room for improvement where we can change a lot and improve a lot. And by doing so, we also have, of course, to be aware that the Japanese culture has some very important, valuable ways of dealing with loss and also with grief. For example, also the whole way of the Japanese funeral, and also the way of remembering the dead. And so they have very valuable cultural assets in dealing with these issues, which I always stress that we should not easily give up. For example, in recent years, one thing that worries me is so-called famous people in Japan, they say no funeral. Ne? Now, no funeral is not a good way, because the funeral can be an important way of support in the painful grief process. I can give you one example. A friend of mine here, a professor at Sophia University, died. It started this way. He asked me, we had a series of lectures, and he came to me and said, well, could you give the lecture at my date, where I am supposed to give, because I don't feel well, and then I will take it at your place. I said, that's fine with me. And then the next day, I found out that he had died. And then I looked up the Asahi newspaper, and it says he had died, there will be no funeral. So I suggested to the wife, if you want, both had no religious connection, and the whole family, I said, if you want, I can reserve the Ignatius Church for a memorial service, not for a Catholic mass or so, simply for a memorial service for you, wonderful husband, because he was I respect him as a great teacher, and he is highly respected by his students and so. And so she is eventually said, yes, that would be all right. Then the Ignatius Church has 800 seats. 800 seats were filled with his present students that had taken his lecture on that year, and with many graduates of our university, and of course all the professors of his department came. And the wife was so amazed that her husband had been such a popular professor, and there were two girls, children were coming, one a junior high school, one a senior high school girls, and they couldn't believe it that her father had been such a popular professor. They had only seen him from another side. I don't know what side, but for them, for the wife and for the two daughters, this was a very important experience of social support in their painful grief process after a sudden death of their husband and father. So thank you for your attention.